Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, the Startups Edition for Monday, August 3rd, 2026.
Our thesis today centers on the transition from experimental integration to structural permanence. We are moving past the era of isolated pilot programs toward a period where intelligence is being hard-coded into the very architecture of the enterprise.
It is no longer about testing the tech but embedding it.
Worth noting, we are observing a fundamental shift in how value is captured across the stack.
We begin by examining the enterprise AI playbook and the critical challenges of scaling the application layer. 1 month, that is the difference between 7 new automated customer journeys and just 3, according to a recent case study involving Decagon's deployment.
It's the difference between a scalable product and a high-priced consulting gig.
Today, we're looking at the enterprise AI playbook, specifically how the most ambitious startups are moving past the wow, look at this chatbot phase and into the much more lucrative and much more difficult business of scaling the application layer.
Because the real money isn't in building the engine anymore. It's in building the specialized vehicle that actually knows how to drive through a regulated bank's infrastructure without crashing.
Right, though I suspect driving through infrastructure might be a bit of an optimistic metaphor for what is essentially just a massive, complex plumbing job with better marketing.
It's more than plumbing. We're seeing a fundamental structural shift in how software functions. For decades, software was a passive digital filing cabinet, a place to store data. But as we see with companies like Lassie, targeting the 16,000 dental practices in the US, software is moving from information storage to labor execution. We're talking about an agent that doesn't just hold your patient records, but actually handles the $200,000 annual administrative drain of billing disputes and appointment scheduling.
So the software is essentially trying to become an employee.
So here's the picture that creates a massive opportunity in what some call non-categories, industries like dentistry or plumbing where the incumbent software was actually just a human being with a clipboard. If you can automate the fuzzy cognitive work, like resolving a patient dispute over an insurance claim, you aren't just selling a tool, you're selling a reduction in labor scarcity.
I assume there's a catch. It's never just deploy an agent and print money.
The catch is the last mile. You can't just give a dentist a login and expect them to configure an API. To win in these fragmented markets, startups have to build a consumer-grade onboarding architecture that can link insurance portals and bank accounts within 48 hours. It's a massive technical hurdle because the source of truth for these workflows isn't on the internet. It's trapped in the heads of office managers.
Which sounds like a nightmare for any engineer trying to scale.
It is.
That's why we're seeing the rise of the Forward Deployed Engineer, or FDE. These are engineers sent directly into the client's environment to map out undocumented workflows. But as the A16Z show noted, the FDE role is currently a discovery mechanism rather than a permanent service model. If a startup keeps using FDEs as a crutch, they just become a glorified version of Accenture. The goal is to use those engineers to excrete product, to take what they learn manually and bake it into the core software so the human is eventually phased out.
Excrete product. That is a particularly unappetizing way to describe product development, Alex.
It's visceral but accurate. You're taking the waste of manual implementation and turning it into the substance of the platform. And that brings us to the glass box versus black box debate. Decagon's Jesse Zhang recently highlighted a client that switched from Sierra to Decagon, specifically because Sierra's reliance on these manual, FDE-heavy deployments created too much operational drag. Decagon's approach allows the client to iterate on their own, launching 7 journeys in a single month.
So the transparency of the box is actually the feature.
In the enterprise, you need guardrails and governance. You can't have a black box making decisions about airline rebookings or bank transfers. The real moat for these startups isn't the underlying model intelligence. Everyone has access to OpenAI or Anthropic. It's the infrastructure of deployment. It's the ability to manage complex business logic, compliance monitoring, and the integration with messy legacy CRMs.
So the smarter the model gets, the less of a moat the startup has.
It's actually the opposite. As the models get smarter, the model factory approach becomes more vital. The A16Z show pointed out that the real competitive advantage is building the internal infrastructure to compress the time between a new foundational model being released and the deployment of a task-specific, fine-tuned version. You aren't just using a model, you're running a factory that constantly deprecates and retrains smaller, specialized models to optimize for latency and cost.
I see. So you use the big, expensive frontier models to figure out the logic, and then you train a tiny, cheap model to do the actual heavy lifting.
We can trace that further. It eliminates the false trade-off between intelligence, cost, and latency. By using smaller open-source models for specific tasks, you can actually achieve higher performance and lower latency than a massive general-purpose model could ever provide for a narrow task like, say, a voice agent for a hotel concierge.
And I suppose this leads to the inevitable economic consequence. We end up doing even more of the thing we were trying to automate.
You're describing the Jevons paradox. As the A16Z show noted in customer support, increasing the efficiency and lowering the cost of services actually drives an increase in total support volume. When it costs 10 cents to run a high-quality, personalized interaction instead of $10, companies don't just pocket the savings, they expand the service to every single customer every single time.
It's a feedback loop of infinite cheap automated interactions.
And that loop is getting recursive. We're seeing the emergence of agentic software, where a second, more powerful agent like Decagon's Duet is actually used to manage the first agent. This agent for agents automates the manual labor of creating operating procedures, monitoring conversations, and setting up tests. It's automating the very tasks that humans used to do to manage the automation.
It sounds like a digital version of a snake eating its own tail.
But a snake that is getting much, much faster at eating. And while we talk about labor replacement, the primary bottleneck we're seeing isn't actually the technology or the token cost, it's human capital. The ability of these models to follow instructions means that instead of reducing headcount, we're seeing a hiring arms race. When tools enable faster development or faster support, the strategic response is to increase the volume of features and interactions, which necessitates more people to manage the sheer scale of the output.
The efficiency is actually just a way to expand the scope of work.
Whether it's a CRM evolving into a headless database that agents interact with via APIs, or a small business using context capture agents to track every detail of a complex deal, the goal is to move from reactive tools to proactive, orchestrated business processes. The software isn't just a place to look at data anymore, it's the layer that executes the work.
Investors should watch the deployment velocity of these glass box platforms over traditional black box vendors.
Keep an eye on the unit of output metrics. If companies start prioritizing successful conversation outcomes over reducing token costs, the scaling phase is officially in full swing.
But if the software is starting to do the labor, does it eventually need a body of its own? Are we just going to ignore the fact that every revolutionary tech founder is currently obsessed with replacing a perfectly good human being with a very expensive, very clumsy piece of hardware? This whole rise of physical AI trend feels like a massive capital sinkhole where we're trying to solve problems that don't actually exist.
I think you're missing the structural driver here, Maya. It isn't about replacing people for the sake of it. It's about addressing a massive, quantifiable labor deficit in high-risk sectors. We're seeing a fundamental shift from automating bits, digital software, to automating atoms, physical processes.
Right, because nothing says innovation like a billion-dollar venture trying to teach a tractor how to move without a human. It sounds like we're just trading software bugs for much more expensive, much more dangerous mechanical failures.
But the math on the efficiency gains is what's driving the venture's interest. Take Travis Kalanick's new venture, Atoms. He's not looking at humanoid robots dancing in living rooms. He's looking at retrofitting heavy machinery in mining and food production. The goal is to use sensors and actuators to boost productivity by 30 to 40%. He's even talking about no-entry mines where everything from drilling to haulage is autonomous, effectively removing humans from the most hazardous pits entirely.
We're just moving the humans from the mining pit to a comfortable air-conditioned control room. That sounds like a very expensive way to achieve the same result with more latency.
It's more about the full stack of the industry. Kalanick's vision is a no-entry model that uses specialized, wheel-based automation for things like road grading or freight movement. It's about reducing the cost of goods. He even predicts that by replacing human drivers with robotic couriers, the cost of an autonomous burrito delivery could drop from $12 to about 75 cents.
75 cents. Wonderful. I'll be sure to alert the entire global workforce that their livelihoods are being disrupted by the quest for cheaper lunch.
But there is a massive technical bottleneck that makes this harder than just writing a better LLM. As Kasar Yaunis from Applied Intuition pointed out, the moat in physical AI isn't just the code. It's solving the real-time performance constraint where models have to operate within millisecond windows on actual hardware. Unlike a chatbot, a robot can't think for 10 seconds if it encounters an unexpected obstacle in a mine.
Which brings us back to the clumsy hardware problem. If the software is brilliant but the robot can't navigate a slightly muddy path, the whole investment evaporates.
That's exactly why the focus is shifting toward what Fei-Fei Li calls spatial intelligence. The idea isn't just to train models on text, but to create world models that understand 3D space and physics. The A16Z show noted that scalable robotic learning will rely on a real-to-sim-to-real pipeline. Basically, companies like World Labs are building massive synthetic digital worlds so robots can train in simulation, where it's safe and cheap, before ever touching a real piece of hardware.
We're building a digital playground so robots can practice being much more expensive versions of themselves.
It's about overcoming data scarcity. You can't scrape the internet to teach a robot how to navigate an unstructured warehouse or an Amazonian iron ore mine. You need massive proprietary datasets of physical interactions. If you can bridge the gap between digital commands and mechanical hydraulics, you unlock the ability to treat entire industries like a computer architecture. As the A16Z show framed it, we're moving toward an atoms-based computer where manufacturing is the CPU and logistics is the network moving packets of goods.
It still feels like we're ignoring the energy bill. A large language model is a massive energy hog, but a robot trying to perform heavy industrial tasks. The power requirements for a robot to match human dexterity without a massive battery or tether is still a massive, unsolved hurdle.
True, the efficiency gap is huge. But the economic driver is the calculator business model. In sectors like long-haul trucking, where drivers face severe health risks and labor shortages, the adoption of autonomous systems isn't driven by how cool it is, but by a mile-by-mile reduction in operating costs. If the automation lowers the OPEX enough to overcome the hardware cost, the momentum becomes unstoppable.
Investors in heavy industry need to stop looking for cool and start looking for reliable before they dump another billion into specialized wheels.
Watch for the first major mining conglomerate to report a sustained, multi-quarter increase in ore output directly tied to an autonomous fleet deployment.
But if we can automate the physical world, does that mean the fight for control is moving from the courtroom to the server room? We're essentially watching a high-stakes tug-of-war between two massive, invisible forces, the drive for permissionless innovation and the massive, heavy hand of state regulation. If you had to place a bet, Alex, are we heading toward a decentralized frontier, or is the era of the walled garden inevitable?
It depends on whether the kill shot lands first. If we're talking about the intersection of crypto and AI, the tension isn't just about rules, it's about who is held responsible when the code does something unexpected.
Because unexpected is a very polite way of saying the algorithm accidentally crashed the bond market.
In looking at the current legislative push for the Clarity Act, the real danger for startups isn't the volatility of Bitcoin, but the potential for downstream liability. Mark Andreessen has been quite vocal about this, arguing that if developers are held legally responsible for the unpredictable third-party misuse of the code they write, it effectively destroys the open-source ecosystem.
Wait, so you're telling me a developer could be sued because someone used their open source library to, I don't know, automate a rug pull?
That's the mechanism. It creates an uninsurable risk. If you can't insure against the downstream use of your software, venture capital dries up, academic research halts, and we enter what Andreessen calls a death spiral for the scientific ecosystem. It's not just a legal headache, it's a fundamental threat to the ability to do computer science as a field.
It sounds like a very efficient way to ensure only the giants with massive legal departments survive.
And that brings us to the geopolitical layer. We're seeing a massive innovation leadership war between the US and China. While the Trump administration is reportedly weighing new restrictions on Chinese open source models due to cybersecurity concerns, there's a massive structural imbalance happening right now. Sriram Krishnan noted that Chinese models like Kimi K3 are already providing high-performance alternatives, and American security professionals might actually start bypassing U.S. frontier models like Claude because the U.S.-imposed safety guardrails are simply too restrictive.
So the U.S. creates a safety cage, and the rest of the world just starts building better houses outside of it.
Two things stand out. It's like the 1990s encryption fight. When the U.S. classified SSL as ammunition under ITAR, it forced companies like Netscape to ship weakened software, which essentially handed the global market to foreign competitors. We see the same pattern in AI. Ben Horowitz has argued that the real domestic threat isn't a sleeper agent model from China, but a U.S.-based monopoly like Anthropic or OpenAI that can unilaterally cut off competitors or overcharge application providers under the guise of safety.
I mean, we are literally discussing the possibility of a software-induced death spiral and a global crypto arms race in the same breath. I need a stronger espresso.
But the shift is already happening. We're seeing a move toward a commodity-style pricing model. As high-performing open-weight models proliferate, it's eroding the gross margins for the big frontier labs and disproportionately benefiting neocloud providers. The industry is moving from proprietary dominance toward a landscape where the underlying infrastructure is becoming a commodity.
Even if the crypto side is trying to find middle ground.
The Clarity Act is attempting to do exactly that by bifurcating the market. It would allow tokens to transition from SEC to CFTC oversight once they hit specific decentralization thresholds. It's trying to move from experimental DeFi to institutional finance. But even with that, there's a massive gap. The landscape is currently split into a regulated 15%, mostly stablecoins, and an unregulated 85%, where the underlying blockchains lack the same oversight as the assets built on them.
So the foundation is still made of sand, even if the skyscrapers are regulated.
That's the structural vulnerability. If the US focuses too much on the bank shot diplomacy of export controls and developer liability, we might win the regulatory battle but lose the entire technological ecosystem.
Developers need to lobby hard against any clause that turns code into a legal liability.
Keep an eye on the next round of US export controls on AI chips. If they start targeting the weights of open source models, the walled garden becomes a permanent reality.
But if we can control the code, can we also control the biology of the people writing it? We used to think founder burnout was just a matter of bad sleep and too much caffeine, but we're realizing it's actually a fundamental engineering problem involving cellular decay and neural bandwidth. It's getting to the point where you can't tell if a CEO is pivoting their business model or just undergoing a midlife neuroplasticity crisis, losing their grip on the quarterly roadmap, or literally forgetting the names of their Series B investors.
It's deeper than just burnout. We're seeing a shift toward what we call human performance optimization, where biology becomes a scalable input. The goal for a high-growth founder isn't just stamina, but maintaining high-resolution cognitive function through specific metabolic and neurological interventions.
High-resolution cognitive function. You make it sound like we're upgrading a graphics card rather than just trying to survive a board meeting.
But the hardware is exactly what's being upgraded. The Tim Ferriss Show highlighted a massive strategic shift where major AI companies are acquiring biotech firms, moving from simply processing text to developing tech that can write to the nervous system. We're looking at a future where the first practical applications of writing to the nervous system will likely manifest in sleep technology, using targeted mechanical or electrical stimulation to bypass the placebo effect and force rapid sleep onset.
So instead of a better mattress, we're getting a neural override switch.
The pattern is clear. It's not just about sleep, it's about leveraging golden windows of neuroplasticity. For instance, the efficacy of the 1DTMS protocol for depression relies on using D-cycloserine to enhance neuroplasticity, allowing intensive treatment to be compressed from 5 days into a single day. For a founder, this means the ability to use pharmacological and technological synergies to rapidly reformat behavioral patterns or recover from intense psychological stressors.
I'm assuming there's a catch involving how much we have to medicate ourselves to stay optimal.
The real edge comes from managing the metabolic drivers that underpin that plasticity. It's not just pills and potions. It's about optimizing insulin sensitivity and glucose disposal through things like the fasting mimicking diet, which has shown a 53% improvement in glycemic management compared to just 8% in control groups. When you pair that metabolic stability with intermittent high-intensity physiological stressors, like the Norwegian 4x4 protocol, you can create lasting neurological resilience that persists for up to 5 years.
So the strategy is fast, sprint, and use 3D printed supplements to stay sharp enough to read the fine print on your next term sheet.
The implication runs deeper. Even the way we perceive reality is a variable. You can artificially extend your experiential lifespan through linguistic acquisition, learning specific botanical or meteorological terms, for example, which increases the frame rate of your perception, allowing you to experience more reality within the same biological timeframe.
Investors need to start auditing the mitochondrial health of their portfolios as closely as their burn rates. Just keep an eye on the first wave of consumer-grade neurostimulation wearables. If they can actually induce a flow state on command, the definition of talent changes overnight. But if we can optimize the individual, the much harder challenge remains. How do you actually scale a company without the wheels falling off the operation? So, Alex, when a founder says they're optimizing for strategic constraints, are they actually just admitting they've run out of cash?
It depends on whether those constraints are a death spiral or a roadmap. Today, we're looking at scaling with grit, how startups move from chaotic survival to sustainable growth without losing their soul.
Because usually, scaling is just code for burning money until the VCs notice well lost the plot.
Not always. Take Mike Salguero at ButcherBox. Instead of chasing expensive Facebook ads, he implemented a Box One profitability mandate. This forced a shift toward an affiliate model using nutritionists, where the cost to acquire a customer was strictly lower than the initial profit margin of the first shipment.
No more growth at any cost if you can't even pay for the box you just sent out.
It turned marketing into a predictable variable cost. Masters of Scale noted that by paying influencers a residual tail fee for the lifetime of a subscription, ButcherBox aligned incentives so partners were actually invested in customer retention.
I love a good incentive alignment, provided it doesn't involve machete hacking our way through a supply chain.
That's the danger. Scaling requires transitioning from machete hackers to car drivers, people who manage established processes. But Salguero advocates for a barbell strategy in hiring, pairing high-grit, inexperienced talent with low-ego, seasoned professionals to prevent the culture from becoming too rigid.
Because the moment you hire only car drivers, you're just a slow-moving target for a more agile competitor.
The data tells a story. You have to watch out for the marketplace trap. Masters of Scale highlighted how VC pressure can force founders to stick to a failing high-growth model because investors demand the original plan, even when the unit economics are broken. Salguero avoided this by bootstrapping, which insulated ButcherBox from the 2017 market volatility that crushed companies like Blue Apron.
Founders need to prioritize that first shipment margin before they start dreaming of global dominance. Watch for any subscription-based hardware startup that scales its user base without a simultaneous increase in its logistics headcount. If the problem creation rate starts outstripping their ability to solve it, the whole structure will go underwater. As we wrap up this edition, the thread connecting everything from Decagon's dental automation to the rise of physical robotics is clear. We are witnessing the end of the interface era and the beginning of the agency era. We've moved past merely chatting with models. We are now witnessing the integration of autonomous logic into the very plumbing of the enterprise and the physical factory floor.
It's a telling detail. And for the founders and VCs in the room, the single most important implication is that the primary unit of value is shifting from features capability to verifiable outcome. If you are an operator at a firm like A16Z or even a large-scale enterprise like Accenture, your calculus can no longer be about how much data a model can process, but whether that model can execute a high-stakes, regulated task, like managing a bank's infrastructure or a robotic warehouse, without creating a liability nightmare. The real moat is no longer the intelligence itself, but the governance and the deployment layer that makes that intelligence usable in the real world.
It's a move from managing software to managing agents that have both digital and physical consequences.
There's a signal here. If you want to know if this thesis is holding, watch the next deployment cycle of Kimi K3 or similar large-scale localized models. If we see these models successfully driving industrial productivity in logistics without a proportional spike in mechanical failure or regulatory pushback, then we'll know the infrastructure of deployment is actually stabilizing.
That's the signal to watch. Thanks for joining us this Monday. We'll see you next week.